Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Deepak Singh had a lot going for him as a young man in India, an MBA degree and a job with the BBC World Service that he liked a lot. But he fell in love with an American, married her, and moved overseas to be with her, to a community in Virginia where the only place that would hire him was an electronics franchise in a shopping mall. So he donned a name tag and khaki pants and set about learning what it meant to live like an American. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Professionally, that job was unquestionably a step down for Singh. But as he'll tell us, he managed to turn it into a learning experience that gave him significant insight into American culture, race relations, and the challenges of the working poor. Deepak Singh is a writer and independent radio producer now. His new memoir is called How May I Help You? An Immigrant's Journey from MBA to Minimum Wage. And he joins us this hour from the studios of Maine Public Radio. Deepak, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
You were not one of those kids who grew up dreaming of living in the U.S. You were happy in India. You went to school there. You got a great job. What sort of expectations did your parents have for your adult life?
Good question. Thank you. They also did not imagine that I would go to U.S. one day. And they thought, you know, I would grow up in India and get a good education, get a good job, marry an Indian woman and have kids and live with them forever and ever. That changed.
They surprised you and maybe themselves by being fine with the fact that you wanted to marry someone who was not only not Indian, but not Hindu, not chosen by them. It turns out they really liked your wife.
Yes. It was my wife who, she's very likable and she spoke very good fluent Hindi, and my parents couldn't speak very good English, so they immediately liked her because of her language skills. And after a year of knowing her, when I proposed the idea, they weren't shocked, and they said, you know, it's fine. She may not be a Hindu or an Indian girl or the one that we had imagined, but she looks like she's a perfect person to be in the family.
Not many people get an MBA and then go to work for the BBC. How did that happen for you?
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing, that I got an MBA, and soon after an MBA, I realized that that was not the degree I wanted. But everybody in India, you know, if they want to get education, they want to make sure that the degree gets them a job. And that's what my parents wanted for me. And I went for it and I finished the MBA, but my heart wasn't in it. And I was doing jobs here, teaching and some other kinds of jobs. And I met a producer from BBC World Service, and he offered me the job. And I said, sure, why not? And then I'm still making radio.
What's so fascinating to me is that when you were living in India, your English was a huge boost to your career prospects. People would compliment you all the time. You'd been speaking it in school since you were a very small child. Then when you got to the U.S., a lot of people said they had trouble understanding you when you first moved.
Yeah, in India, you know, very few people, a very small percentage of people speak English. And if you speak English in India, your chances of rising and doing well in your career and are increased by many, many times. And I spoke good English. I spent a lot of time in British Library in my hometown and listened to English comedy cassettes and tried to practice speaking like them. And that was one of the reasons why I got my job at BBC World Service. And so I had an advantage over most people because of my English language skills. But when I came to the States, it all of a sudden it became a hurdle. People couldn't understand me, and they wanted me to pronounce things like Pakistan instead of saying Pakistan, say Pakistan, Baghdad instead of Baghdad. Uh-huh. I was thought, you know, these are the places I know how to pronounce. So like, no. This is not you pronounce here. You need to pronounce it the way people understand it here. So, I mean, that was one of the examples. But it took me a while to acclimatize myself with the American, you know, accent and the local slang and phrasings. It was definitely a hurdle. But I mean, I'm still learning.
Well, I can't imagine anybody says they don't understand you now who lives in the United States.
Thank you.
Before you lived, I mean, you were, I want to make it clear, you were very well educated, but I wonder what sources of information colored your mental picture of the United States. How did you picture the U.S. before you ever lived here?
You know, mostly by watching films, Hollywood films. I watched several films in theaters, like Home Alone. And I mean, these are films people would laugh at. This is a kid movie, but it was so hilarious. It shows you a Chicago neighborhood, you know, and the kid is lost in snow, is stumbling and making mistakes. And that is something very, very different, which is totally unlike where I grew up. Snow and houses and cars and people like wearing overcoats, walking down the street. And so I thought of America and as, of course, somewhere cold and also very wealthy. You know, I also saw one of the films called Miami Blues, and you see all those posh cars, you know, convertibles. And you imagine this is what people do, drive convertibles, Ferraris and BMWs everywhere. So America was like a dreamland kind of place.
You write about the fact that you, you know, you had this amazing revelation that, like, in the U.S., even people who are, you know, janitors or have jobs that we consider to be pretty humble, they have cars, which is not the case in other parts of the world. But it didn't sort of mean the same in terms of being a status symbol as it might elsewhere.
In the United States?
Yeah.
People do. I mean, here in America, you need a car to get to work, and if you don't have a vehicle, you may not have a job. So to have a job, you need a vehicle, and you can only have a vehicle if you have a job. It's dog trying to chase its own tail, a vicious cycle. So but it's not necessarily a status symbol, because it's something you need. It's not you are showing off. And most people who are janitors or working menial jobs who have cars may not be a flashy car necessarily. They just need a set of four wheels, and they just want to get one place to the other. But in India, it's if you have a car, it's a lot of times it's mostly for the status, not so much for the convenience. And people, like, still today, you know, if you know, I go to India, I see more people have cars than they did when I was there, and they mostly park it in their home. They still use a motorcycle because it is more convenient. But the car is there to show that they can afford it, they have the money, and they can show off to people.
So when you first moved to Virginia to join your wife, she was living with roommates because she'd been single before. It sounds like such a hard adjustment. They weren't so happy to have another body sharing their space, and you're trying to sort of get this new marriage off the ground.
Right. It was hard. You know, you move into a house and the first thing was that I had never left my parents' home. The first time I left my parents' home was when I left India and I came to America, 10,000 miles away, straight. And all of a sudden you enter a house which is very different. It looks very different, built very different. It's a brick house, but also wooden floors. And you want to, I mean, like, when you walk, the floor squeaks, and different kind of stove and coffee maker and stove and smells. And you have people who were also different. They are not, it's not a family. It's like grad students who have 2-3 rooms, and each one of them shares, they have their own room in one, this big house. And then it was me, the guy from India, just arrived, you know, it's totally clueless, doesn't know how things work, you know, and didn't know that there were also curious objects around the house, which I was I didn't understand the idea of personal space in America. When people, like, you, now I know that if people don't want you to be around them, they can give you subtle hints which tells you that, okay, it's you can just go or leave me alone, which I didn't understand back then. And I would constantly try to hover around other people's desk or try to talk to them and not understand and take eggs out of the fridge which belong to somebody else and cook them, and people look at me like I mean, now I'd know that they don't actually want you to eat their eggs, but I didn't understand then. I just still kept cooking and offer them their own eggs. So it was quite an adjustment. And also back then, I didn't have a work permit because I had to wait for 3 months mm-hmm. to get my working visa. So I was mostly homebound and I didn't know any Indians and I had no friends. So I was sitting on the couch watching TV and just whiling my time around and reading books and listening to some music here and there. But mostly people got tired of me. This guy is now sitting here. He's like from India. He cannot understand the humor. He can speak English, but it's like, you know, two different people. He can speak English, but he speaks differently and he has a different sense of understanding, different sense of humor. Mm. So it was a big time cultural clash there. And I would walk around. I would go out and get lost sometimes and ask random people to find my house. And thinking of that now, it sounds funny now, but it was hard times back then.
Well, and you, for your part, were kind of appalled. You had never been around people who drank quite as much as your wife's grad student friends, which is not so uncommon, but it was a little appalling. And then they spoke openly about sex in mixed company, which is something you just had not grown up around.
Yes. Back when I was growing up in India, we would talk about sex, but mostly it was be men, like young 17, 16-year-old boys and having bizarre ideas about female body and sex. And like our only information came from our own misinformed information and whatever we learned from the class, but that was not enough. And all of a sudden you come to this country and I mean, most of these grad students were like PhD students in anthropology, sociology, and they were very intelligent people, and they would sit on the dining table and drink copious amounts of alcohol and then get into sometimes very graphic talks. And it would be, I mean, I couldn't take much alcohol, so I would sit there and listen to them, and I wonder, like, how can you, like, eat your, you know, bagel or whatever and still, like, talk about sex? It's kind of like two different atmosphere. You can maybe, I mean, so it was difficult for me to understand, like, is this what Americans do all the time? Mm. And did I really make the right decision? What am I doing here? I don't belong to this place. And did I make a mistake by marrying my wife? Because I only knew my wife in India before that. And all of a sudden I was in India, in America, in her home, and it was a different, her whole different incarnation. And I didn't know what to expect from her. She didn't know how to transition me from my Indian life to American, and it took a while, but a lot of bumps along the way.
So you finally did get that work permit, and you ended up working at this place that you call Electronics Hut, which, to give listeners a shorthand understanding, it sounded to me a lot like a Radio Shack, but that's the kind of place it was in a mall.
Sort of like that.
Mm-hmm. How did you get that job?
Well, I never wanted a job in an electronics store. I wanted a job in radio. I wanted to make radio. I wanted to produce radio. I wanted to write stories. It was like, as I said, that, you know, I had a problem with my accent. So a lot of radio stations turned me down because of that. And so I ended up writing news for local radio stations, but they were like mostly volunteer positions. And I needed money. So I started applying everywhere. And I had applied a lot of other retail stores, but this is the one that I got. And they interviewed me, and I don't know what they saw in my resume. They said, hey, this guy can sell some cameras and batteries and wires and cables. So here I was on the sales floor wearing khaki pants and a blue shirt selling electronics to Americans.
We'll hear more about that in just a minute from my guest, now writer and independent radio producer Deepak Singh. His new memoir is called How May I Help You? An Immigrant's Journey from MBA to Minimum Wage. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find us on Twitter @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with independent radio producer and writer Deepak Singh, whose new book is called How May I Help You? An Immigrant's Journey from MBA to Minimum Wage. He took a job at a mall electronics store after moving from India to the United States to be with his new wife. That was over a decade ago, and we're talking about that time now. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERATHINK. Deepak, you write with great empathy about many of the people that you met. But I have to say, in this book, American cultural sensitivity to a newcomer does not come off well. People said and did really dumb things around you.
Yes. You meet several people, like 20, 30, 40, sometimes more on a busy day, on a weekend, on a sales floor. And not everybody is nice or, considerate. And they may be angry with their own stuff, something's going on in their own lives, or they're mad at a particular thing, at the product or something. And they, either see this person working in a store, and it could be me or it could be somebody else, and they can take the frustration out on me. And there were lots of other people who were very nice. So it's a small percentage of people who were not so nice. And I mentioned that in the book here and there, but I also didn't understand in the beginning some of those things that people said to me, what they meant, because growing up in India, there's caste system. People can judge you on the basis of your last name and tell like whether you belong to a lower caste or higher caste, and they might say something to you. But I never grew up in India thinking that I could be anything but Indian. I think this guy is Deepak Singh. He is like high caste Hindu, but that's it, nothing else. But in America, people, especially in the sales floor atmosphere, people didn't understand what Hindu meant, or they thought of me as oftentimes as someone from the Middle East. And a lot of times I would say I'm from India. It's like, oh yeah, I don't trust Middle East. And then I would think India is not really there. And so I had to think about my own identity a lot, because all of a sudden I was the guy from the Middle East. Some people thought of me like that, and not everybody, but and the guy, it was not so much about India, but mostly in the guy, the Middle Eastern guy. And so people, when I found out what it meant, later on I understood what was going on. Why were they asking me that, if I owned gas wells? And I mean, what that meant in the beginning, or things like that. But you're right. Yeah, there were some moments like that. Like, I was working in a different country, in a different atmosphere, so I had to get used to everything.
Your boss at Electronics Hut, who doesn't seem to have, mean motivations, but she would call you at home and say, "What do you know about what's happening in Fallujah?" And you'd have to tell her, I don't know."
Yeah, she's very nice. She was very nice, but she didn't know exactly where I was from. She supported me a lot. I have a lot of respect for her. Mm-hmm. But in the beginning, she thought, this guy must be from somewhere close to Fallujah, and this guy must be an expert on Middle East. You can just call him and ask him anything that's going on in Fallujah, what's going on in Iraq or Iraq or Iran or anywhere in those areas. And I would tell her, look, I know Fallujah is in the Middle East. And she would smile and it's like, yep, I know, you would know. So, yeah, but it was a learning experience for me and her, and we became a good team.
So you came from a place where the caste system had a lot to do with how you were viewed socially. And you came to a country where race and skin color have a lot to do with how you're treated socially, what your career prospects are. And you sort of saw all that play out even at this little outlet that you were working at.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I also didn't think of myself as brown or not white. I thought just Indian. But mm-hmm. here, color was a big factor. Who was white? Who was the race, who was Hispanic, you know, are you Hispanic, are you Middle Eastern, or are you black, are you white? So I saw that happening right there in front of me, and I would ask questions. I would talk to my colleagues, Ron and Jackie, and talk to them how they felt. And slowly I figured out that Ron would often say, one of the characters in the book, talk about his him being black, and although he was several shades lighter than my skin tone, but I would still think, I mean, you consider yourself black. And he thought sometimes he was disadvantaged because of his race. And how he talked to me, he made me think, you know, I working in and living and growing up in India, I never thought of people who were lower caste and how they felt. And there were a lot of people who came to my home, and they still do, they clean the toilets and they water the garden or wash the dishes. And I never bothered to understand how they might have felt, what was going on in their heads. And I was doing all those menial things on the sales floor. Sometimes I was like vacuuming the floor, even like taking the trash out, and even cleaning the toilet in the back room. And I was that person who was doing stuff in my home in India. And I got to feel like, you know, this is, I'm not a privileged person here. All my privileges of being a high caste Hindu, an educated person, speaking, someone who spoke very good English, they don't matter here. And I'm in a different circumstance here. And the people who work with me, and I mean, I developed a lot of empathy for the people, and for the people who work in India, and for the people who are working here with me. So, yeah, it was a whole, like, you know, awakening for me to see people who work in retail and sales and trying to make ends meet, making minimum wage and paying mortgages, raising kids, all on $7 or $8 an hour, and just the idea of America began to change very soon for me.
Your coworker Jackie was a single mom, and you realized one day she didn't have enough money to eat lunch.
Yeah, she one day it was her break, and she was sitting in the back room. I said, "Hey, Jackie, why don't you go on lunch and have your lunch? This is your lunchtime." And she looked at me and said, "Like, Deepak, you know, I would, but I don't have any money." It just broke my heart. I was like, I couldn't imagine a person in America not being able to eat because she or he doesn't have enough money, like $5-6 to buy even a slice of pizza. I offered her the money, and she did, and that was changed my view of America. How people like may not appear poor to you, but they are struggling and they have a lot of financial problems. In India, the poverty is in your face. You go to a restaurant, and you can be eating something which is like, you know, 1,000 rupees, which is $20 worth of food, and right outside the glass window, a small child, a homeless child with his face looking at you, and you just become, you don't feel that so much because that happens all the time. But here in America, you just don't see poverty on the street and like unfolding in front of you. But here, like when Jackie told me she wanted $5 or $6 or $8, it told me something, that, you know, there's a lot of sadness behind the bright lights.
As time went on, you ran into and then eventually met some other Indian people, either immigrants or people of Indian descent. And initially, you had kind of a complicated relationship with other Indians in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Yes. Can you talk about that?
Yes, sure. I was since my wife was doing her doctorate, and I was living in a family housing situation where lots of other students were also living. And most of those students who were from India, they were either PhD students or they had they went to very elite schools in India, IITs, which is like top, it's like an MIT in India. Mm-hmm. And they can be snobby sometimes. I mean, I'm not speaking for everybody else, but they they know that they've gone to the best schools in India, and they can't look down on you, people who haven't done so well. And I used to hang out with them, and you know, I'd always try to avoid those people back in India. And all of a sudden, I was living next door to them, so I had a strange relationship with them. I was always had to prove that I was just as good as them, or it was hard. So I still was good friends with them. Not all of them were snobby. Some of them were nice people. But once one of my friends who would come to the store and hang out with me once in a while, and one day he came to the mall and his parents were visiting, and he walked in front of the store, and I came out to say hello to his parents who were visiting from India. So he acted like that they didn't know what I was doing, and he tried to cover up for me, saying that I don't work there. And I was going to tell them, because I was coming out of the store wearing the uniform, and he tried to cover for me, and I felt a little uncomfortable. You know, it was more demeaning than me admitting that I worked there. And he was well-meaning. He was trying to save me from embarrassment, but it turned out to be more embarrassing. So yeah, I mean, I know situations like that were difficult to face once in a while.
My guest is writer and independent radio producer Deepak Singh. His new memoir is called How May I Help You? An Immigrant's Journey from MBA to Minimum Wage. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink. I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to Think. Deepak, I want you to talk a little bit about Black Friday, because I can't imagine what this, like the kickoff to the holiday season is like if you work in retail and you have never really even heard of this phenomenon before. Can you tell us about your experience of your first Black Friday working in retail?
Yeah, it was my boss told me, "Hey, Deepak, you know, we need to be prepared for Black Friday." I said, "What is that? Why is that Friday different? Why is it called Black Friday?" She said, "Oh, you don't know. It's when, you know, the entire United States of America wakes up at 4 a.m. to go to the electronics store and buy everything that is on sale." I couldn't imagine. Like, why? I mean, why would you do that? But I think that's a tradition, you know, the day after Thanksgiving, and people go, and there's huge sales in every store, and people want to grab things. People wait for the entire year for this day. And she said that, you know, she was going to cook a lot of food and muffins and bagels and lots of, she was going to bring a lot of food and prepare us. And this was going to be a 15 or 14 hour work day, starting at 5 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, something like that, and going until 10 or 11 in the night. And she also said that's going, you can make a good amount of money that day, because people spend a lot of money that night, that day. And so I said, okay. And she said, you know, we arrived at the store at 5 o'clock in the morning, and everybody was still waking up, and we had coffee. And she said, "Hey, go ahead and turn the lights on. It's time to open the store, and there are a lot of people waiting outside. And as soon as you open the store, there'll be like, you know, a big mass of people would walk in, and they would be angry. They probably haven't slept the night before. They're still drunk, maybe, and they might smell different. And but you have to be nice to them. you cannot like react, or if they're rude to you, and you have to maintain your decorum, and be as good a salesperson as you can." And so, I mean, every single word of her was true. As soon as we opened the door, people walked in with flyers in their hands, with kids, you know, people just walking around like as if it was a strange, like another end of the world situation. People like grabbing stuff off the shelf and knocking things down, and just piling it up on the counter. And a couple of ladies also got into fight. It was a pretty fierce fight, and I didn't know what to do. Like, you know, try to be the mediator in the fight, or still like keep helping them, and there was a lot of drama that unfolded. And we also sold a lot, and by the time like that first wave left, the store was looked like, you know, it was hit by a hurricane. Everything was on the floor, and you know, things knocked off the peg, and It was different. And also, the first thing, also another thing that I noticed was when I woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go to the store, I saw people, like, in hordes, walking on the street and paved, like, sidewalks, going somewhere, just going somewhere. And I looked and I asked my wife, what is going on? Where are they going? And she said, they must be going to shop. People were just walking on the streets. And that reminded me of a big Hindu pilgrimage that happens every few years in India. And people in millions amass near the river Ganges to take a holy dip. And they walk for miles and miles and miles. And this reminded me of a similar thing, and as if it was a ritual, it's a pilgrimage. But a pilgrimage of different sorts, you know, with materialism instead of devoutness.
It sounds really nauseating, you know, and it's funny because I don't shop on Black Friday, but I've known it's a thing for a while. And your book really helped me realize how ludicrous this tradition is that we have in this country.
I actually, to be honest, I think I may have shopped once or twice as a sales, like as a customer. Mm-hmm. I worked twice on Black Friday, but I agree with you. It's pretty ridiculous. You know, I mean, I have no desire to wake up at 5 a.m. in the morning to buy an alarm clock that is on sale. You know, I can wait and spend $2 more and keep my sanity.
Yeah, and sometimes it seems like people were wanting to buy things just because they existed, not because it was something that they really had needed and saved up for or whatever.
Yeah, a lot of people who walked in, they wanted, like, suppose if there was a toy Rubicon or some kind of, an alarm clock, and it was on sale, people wanted to buy all 10 of them instead of just one, because they were trying to save it. They wanted to win. They wanted to make sure that they got all the alarm clocks and nobody else got, or they wanted to buy it because they were thinking of giving it as a Christmas present in a month. And it didn't seem like people were buying because they needed that, but mm-hmm. they wanted it. It was more of a want than need that particular day.
We're speaking this hour with writer and radio producer Deepak Singh. His new memoir is called How May I Help You? An Immigrant's Journey from MBA to Minimum Wage. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with writer and radio producer Deepak Singh. His new memoir is called How May I Help You? An Immigrant's Journey from MBA to Minimum Wage. You can join us on Twitter at KERA Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Deepak, I'm sure that I don't say your name like your mom does, but it doesn't seem like a particularly complicated name for me as a native English speaker. You found lots and lots of people struggled to call you the right thing.
You actually sound very good.
Thank you.
Deepak. That's exactly how it is. But some people who called me, pronounced my name incorrectly, they did it on purpose because they were being funny. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times people who called me, oh, your name sounds like Deep Pockets or Tupac.
And you didn't know who Tupac was initially when they would call you.
I had no idea who Tupac was, and they laughed. And I mean, every time somebody called me Tupac, they laughed. But I didn't know what was so funny about it until I Googled name. I was a famous rapper. So, yeah, I'm in India again. I'm growing up. My name was always Deepak, and people called me Deepak. And when I came to the States, and all of a sudden Deepak became Deepak, which was still okay, but then at the store it became Tupac sometimes, and sometimes people like started writing on the schedule and stuff like Tupac schedule. So that became a little bit too much, and like, you know, we can at least spell it correctly if you can't pronounce it.
It has to be an interesting thing to sort of decide as someone who's new and trying to, you know, you want to fit in, you're in this new place, and like, where do you draw the line between, okay, this is how it's going to be in this place, and no, this has to do with my dignity and how I feel about myself.
Yeah, I mean, suppose if you go to India, Chris, people might call you different names. But then if you're working and you're also struggling with those other things, suppose if you're struggling with the heat or the food, you're already sick and somebody's and also pronouncing a name wrong, you can be pretty irritated. And like when I was having a hard time and like slow sales day and people were calling me other things, or I was just struggling, I was tired, not feeling well, and somebody calls my name wrong, it was the last thing I want to hear. So it can be difficult, you know. Somebody, if you're having a rough day and somebody pronounces your name right and it's a fresh breath of air, oh, thank goodness you can pronounce my name right. It feels familiar. So it's one of the things which I didn't mind much, but once in a while I had to, you know, draw a line and say, please pronounce my name right.
All right, let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Liz on the line in San Antonio. Hi, Liz. Go ahead and turn your radio all the way off, please. Thank you.
Yes. Okay. I have a question for Mr. Singh. So I'm just wondering, I was listening to how you said, you know, when you first got to the U.S., you were wondering, is this really what Americans are like, sitting around, you know, just chatting up things, and you know, that was kind of like the grad school city lifestyle. I was wondering, had you decided, let me get out of here and try and, you know, take a look at another place, maybe visit a country town, or, you know, what was the first place that you visited to get a different picture of American lifestyle?
Thank you, Liz. It was a great question. Yes, so that was the first few days, the first week or so, actually first couple of months, and then I visited my wife's my in-laws in rural Pennsylvania, which was very, very different from what I was experiencing in Charlottesville, Virginia. They live on a farm, 100-acre farm, and they live on a house which was built in 1950s or 60s, a really old house, and they're very traditional people. They eat their dinner at 5 o'clock, and they don't call it dinner, they call it supper. And it's all mashed potatoes on a steak, you know, which is raw often. And I, every time I ask them, like my grandfather-in-law, what is rare? Well, he's like, there's like rare medium and there's well done, and what is rare steak? And he would say, that's when you have to hold it down with a fork or it will take off. So that was very different. Now, they didn't drink wine. They didn't, like, they were very proper. No swear words at all in the house. And I felt very comfortable there, amazingly. And the pace of life was very different. And I thought, this is two different worlds. And that was one America, and this is other America, and they're both Americas. And I felt a lot of comfort talking to my grandmother-in-law, who was back then 70 years old, and I sat and talked for hours and hours with her. And so, Liz, that was a big change for me, and I loved visiting her, and I just looked forward to going back every time I had a chance on Thanksgiving or Christmas or whatever moment I got.
And it sounds like they welcomed you.
Yes, they welcomed me, and they made me very comfortable. And I mean, the best thing was that they talked to me, and they sat down, they had a lot of time to talk to me, and they asked me questions about where I was from, what I liked, what I didn't. Of course, they didn't know that I hadn't, as a Hindu, I never ate beef, but that's okay, I ate beef with them. And that was, I mean, I still enjoy my time every time I go back there.
Hmm. You learned during your time at Electronics Hut, there were rules in the United States for talking about race. Your coworker, Jackie, asked you to call your other coworker. Can you tell that story and just be careful of the language on the radio, if you would?
Yes. So they would call, as a fun thing, they would call the person the colloquial language, and I didn't understand. They would call me and all the time and joke around. They would call other people that. And one time I made that mistake, and I called them, and one of the workers, he didn't like it. He wasn't impressed at all. And he took me aside and told me, like, no, you don't do this. You cannot do this, because I asked why, because you do that to me. You call me that. And why can't I say that to you? He said, like, you know, it doesn't work like that, because you're not African American, he said to me, and you cannot do this. So that's when I learned my lesson, and I was lucky that he was my friend, and that was something if I had said somebody else, I wouldn't have, but if I had somebody I didn't know, and I don't know, I would have gotten in some trouble. So, you know, you make mistakes, you know, cultural faux pas, but then you find out that things, some things, there's a big no-no. You cannot do that, but others can do that to you. And also, it has to be in a certain kind of circumstance. It's not something that is, you know, that's okay anywhere in any situation.
We're talking about the N-word, just to be clear, right? It is interesting. I wonder if you, after that experience, were careful about, you know, repeating other colloquial expressions that you heard and thinking, I wonder if this one's okay.
So can you rephrase the question?
Were you more careful after that experience? Like, were you, you know, you would hear something. I think it would be natural to pick up, you know, the local expressions for lots of different things. You know, people might say, we're hanging out. And maybe you said, oh, I didn't say that in India, but I'm going to say it because I've heard my American friends say it. I wonder if you felt like you had to be more careful after that incident with your coworkers.
Yeah, thank you for asking this. Because after that, I became more careful. And I would, if I heard something different, like, one time I said something about a customer to my boss, Cindy, and she said, oh, what is he talking about? He must be smoking crack. And I looked at her like, what does that mean? What is smoking crack? And she started laughing. And she explained to me, look, smoking crack means that guy must be out of his mind. So, you know, I asked every time I heard a new phrase or new slang, I asked her and like checked it, whether it was okay for me to say. I mean, I didn't just go out and say it to somebody. So you were right. So that's, I mean, I was always careful about checking new phrases, one time somebody said, hey, it looks like a nice day to play a hooky. And I thought they were talking about playing hockey. So, you know. So I'm still learning, getting better every day.
Do you think that your colleagues learned something from you?
I think so. I mean, I tried to explain. There's a huge turnover also in a retail store because people come and go in 2 months, 3 months. But I stayed there for a long time. So a lot of people, my boss definitely learned something about me. And she knew that I spoke a different language. And she made me speak that once in a while to see how that sounded. And also asked about my religion. Also, she wasn't always clear what my religion was. But and sometimes my food and what I ate and what things I like and what kind of festivals, she would ask me, well, do you have Christmas in India, you know, or what is Holi, or is this festival of colors or Diwali? So I tried to talk to them about who I was as much as I could in the time we got between customers. So, I mean, they knew I was different. I was from India.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Deepak Singh. We're talking about his book, How May I Help You? An Immigrant's Journey from MBA to Minimum Wage. You decided ultimately that selling, this is really interesting, it was a kind of performance. And once you thought about it that way, it became easier for you.
Yes. It was some kind of a show that you have to put on when you sell. You have to be, you have to show, I mean, it is still true, that you have to show interest in the person, the customer, and talk to them and see and ask questions about what they like, what would they like. And it shouldn't have to be only about the product. And if you can come up with some sort of, you know, human aspect and comfort that you can achieve between the two customers within 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes, and the person can get comfortable, and they know that this person, he cares for my needs. He doesn't just want to sell this because he wants to make some money. They loosen up and they let their guards down, and they're more open to listening to you, your advice. And if you want to tell them about the product, they're more open to it. And I also saw a lot of people whom I tried to sell without like talking. They got put off. They thought, you know, I was just trying to bring the clothes too fast. And once I spent some time, I dragged on too much because I got interested in the story in like the 20, 30 minutes. I spent a lot of time asking questions, not about the product, but something else. My manager also got a little bit ticked off because I was spending too much time with one customer. But then those same people kept coming back, and it became a sort of a show, you know, some sort of a, I wouldn't call it a drama, but it was an act that you had to do it several times a day. And you don't even realize that you're doing it when you're doing it.
You say that if you could go back in time and talk to yourself, you know, the night before you moved to the U.S., you wouldn't say don't go, but there are things you'd want to know. What would have been easier if you'd understood it from the beginning?
First of all, to me, I mean, I'm talking to me. If I could tell myself who was coming here for the first time, the first thing I would want to tell you that you are going to a totally different world. Your privileges, your whatever high class or high caste or education or language or money and the comfort, your mom's food, they're just not going to matter here. You're entering into a different life. You have to start. If your education works here, it can be translated. It's great. If it's not, be prepared to start from the beginning and work hard and just not bring any kind of baggages that you might have had back in India, and be open to everything, and be prepared to take risks and mingle, and that's what I would tell to somebody, like at least to me who was coming in, because I was holding on to a lot of my own like preconceived notions. I didn't want to change in the beginning, and it took me a while to let them go, but when I shed them, I felt a whole lot easier to cope with things and see things in a different light.
You know, native-born Americans like to congratulate new immigrants. Like, you're so lucky you've come here, you've made the right call. And I think we overlook the fact that there's also a lot of sacrifice inherent in coming to the U.S.
Yeah, great question. Thank you. You know, America is truly a wonderful place. It's a great place. You can be who you want. You can be. I mean, the fact that I'm a writer today, and I'm talking to you. I've written a book. People are willing to read it, ask me questions, because America is great. But people in America, and also the people who want to come to America, they think that everybody in America is happy. As soon as you enter this country, you have to be happy. Happy. There's no way you cannot be unhappy, because America is all about being happy. And there's a lot of people who sacrifice a lot of things, you know, they give up a lot, like your family and their home. And for a lot of migrants, they don't have a lot of things that they had back in their own country. It's the unfamiliar things, and they have to start on a new. It's hard. It's, if you go and move to a different country and live there, and you'll miss your family, you'll miss your friends, the language you spoke, the same way, the same colloquial jokes, and the food, and the smells, and the sounds. And I mean, of course, you find a new life, and you can do well in the United States, but you're also giving up a lot, which most people don't understand.
Deepak Singh is a writer and independent radio producer. His new memoir is called How May I Help You? An Immigrant's Journey from MBA to Minimum Wage. Deepak, it's been really interesting. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Facebook and Twitter at KERA Think. The podcast is at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.